I see white man. I have generic white man.
There you go.
Sometimes he has a beard, sometimes he doesn't. And I cannot remember canonically which one he's supposed to have.
I think he's supposed to have, like, mutton chops, not a full beard. Oof. Yeah.
So definitely.
It's not attractive.
Definitely neither. Mutton chops is the worst option.
It just is the worst option.
To end it on the most important thing about Rochester, worst option.
He had the bad facial hair.
Do we think he was attractive? Hard no.
No.
Do we picture him as attractive in our mind's eye? Yes.
Yes, because we want to fall in love with this guy. Come on. We're vain. Insert the sound of jingling bells and a crackling fire. Merry Christmas, Lillian. Hi.
Merry Christmas, Piper. It's so funny because we were just talking about the fact that I hate to break the magic for you guys, as we always do, but we do not record these the morning they go out.
No.
So you are listening to this on Christmas Day, obviously, because you're listening to it the day it comes out, as you do with every single one of our episodes. Thank you so much.
Yeah, obviously.
But we are recording this on the day that Piper and I are going to our special Christmas dinner, just the two of us.
Yeah.
So it is a particularly Christmassy day for us.
It's so Christmassy. I have been just like plowing through a whole bunch of really cheesy Hallmark Channel Christmas movies lately. And so I am definitely in the spirit. I can't wait. And what better present than to talk about Edward Rochester.
Our gift to you is we're going to talk about Christmas's favorite man.
Good old Eddie.
Edward Rochester.
Awesome. We met briefly before this to kind of like make a plan, because this is a character that could take an entire podcast in himself just to discuss. We wanted a bit of structure. So I think what we landed on is the way we're going to kind of approach Mr. Rochester himself is to kind of start at like a high level, sort of like, what are some like both our own like initial first impressions? What are kind of like the initial ideas about this character? And then we're going to dive into some specifics and be like, okay, here are his different like tropes, character types, different phases of his appearance in the story, and how we learn more about him the deeper we go into the Rochester well. Mm-hmm. So
this is so funny because the last episode that we recorded, you guys listened to a different one before. I'm sorry I keep just breaking the magic, was our nature episode. And it's so interesting to me to have this episode because my approach to these two was so exactly the opposite. In that with the nature episode, I was like, it's something that I like have a vague awareness of. Obviously, there's some things that I've seen in this, but it wasn't something that like I naturally pick up on in reading books. It's not an area that like I glom onto. So I did a lot, like we had a lot of passages that we were leaning on, and we talked a lot about like talking things through and kind of like Googling different things was a lot of how we sort of got there. And so I had like 9 pages of notes for that. Mm-hmm. I have half a page of notes for Rochester. Ooh. And that is only because like, I feel like I could talk for an hour without stopping for breath about Rochester. Like Rochester is probably the second biggest character of Jane Eyre, Jane being the main character, obviously.
You say probably. I think you could say 100% Rochester is the second biggest character.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Just fine. Get rid of that doubt right now.
I would. There's a part of me that wants to argue that Bertha's the second main character, but whatever.
Sure. We established already, Lillian, that Rochester is actually the damsel in distress of the story.
Right.
So
I forgot
He takes second billing.
But I think knowing that he's, like, knowing that he's this huge character, like, I could genuinely stop without, like, talk for an hour without breathing about my thoughts about Rochester. Wouldn't need you here for it. And I think that that's part of the reason why I kept my notes light, is I want to sort of think it through with you while we're here on the show and talk it through the way we do so many things on the podcast.
Awesome.
And we both said we don't have passages for this because we're so focused on just generally talking about him, almost as if he's a person.
Yeah.
Because that's how some of these characters feel to me now.
Absolutely. So the way that I kind of, my first little chunk of my kind of organization, because I do have more than half a page, but it's not a terribly long amount. But I figured we could start with like, how do we see Rochester from the surface level? How does he seem on the outside? What are the kind of like first impressions of this character? And I also did a mini breakup of that saying, well, P. Cleavy, personally, my first impression, we all know the story, is simply swoon. That is my first impression of Edward Rochester. And I just said that I thought he was brooding, passionate, and mysterious. That's kind of like the, ooh, who is this guy kind of a thing. But then I also went into more actual analysis details of like, how is he portrayed in the book at first and from the surface level. So,
yeah, I think... I say we jump right into that and talking about him. Lillian's first impressions, I think we all know. They're pretty well documented. My very first impressions of him is what an asshole. Did not enjoy, would not rate highly. Now, here's a fun fact for our listeners as well, is that when we did that first episode almost 2 years ago now, and I talked about... how I couldn't understand why anyone would choose to be with this terrible nightmare man. what I didn't know about me at that time was that I am gay.
Hooray.
So that there's a small chance that that is part of it.
Lillian did not have the swoon effect.
For some reason, I was like, Jane is great and should not be with Rochester.
What if there was a self-insert character named Lillian and she was like a wealthy heiress and like took Jane away from there?
And yeah, and Jane just like was like, they were just like best friends and roommates who like shared a bed and a life together, you know?
Oh, yeah. So perfect and innocent and lovely. They were companions. So when I look at like kind of just how he is portrayed initially in the book, and where I'm starting with this is kind of like, what does the community think of him? What does like Mrs. Fairfax allude to? Because a big thing, again, to keep in mind with these kind of breakdowns is this is Jane's perspective. It's also, if we talked about this a lot in the Nature one, this is essentially her autobiography. She's writing what she remembers. So take all of this with a grain of salt. But kind of the opinion of this person within the community where he exists, I think he comes off as unusual. He is this solitary man. It is well known that he is a wealthy landlord and therefore an eligible bachelor. And I feel like those are the main things. You could probably also throw in, comes from like a well-established like family. But it's just kind of these like kind of basic elements where people are like, like when she asks Miss Fairfax, like, what is he like? And she's like, well, he's hard to describe. And she's like, what do you mean by that? She's like, I don't know. He's nice, but he's kind of weird. Like, so these are kind of like where we start with him.
So I think one of the biggest points that I'm going to talk about with Rochester is A, that the main perspective we get on this is Jane's. So like the main perspective that we get on this, obviously that's true with everything. She's the narrator of the story, but with most of the other characters, we see how they interact with a lot of other people. We see how, we see how other people would describe them. No one else describes Rochester with any level of detail. Like she asked Mrs. Fairfax, but like, we don't really see Rochester interact with people other than the party that he brings in. Mm-hmm. But none of those people like sit and talk to Jane and tell them what they really think about him. Mm-hmm. It's really, what does Jane see when he's around those people? What does Jane see when it's just the two of them? What is Jane's, like, we don't get a perspective from Bertha. Jane and Bertha don't sit down and talk about what she thinks of Rochester. Jane and Grace Poole don't sit down and talk about what they think about Rochester. Like, she doesn't have a friend there that she's sitting and talking with about how they see this guy. It's like, she doesn't even sit down with anybody else in the household and talk about Rochester. And I think that's a really unique way to see a character.
Actually, I feel like the one situation you could possibly say is information that she gets from Adele.
Yes, that's actually true. I think Adele, Mrs. Fairfax, and Jane are the only ones who we get their opinions on Rochester.
Right. Which is interesting, too, almost from, like, I'm thinking of the line where he's like, I can't talk to old women and children. I want to talk to someone who's like me. But, like, the first people that she gets an impression of Rochester from is a kind of rather plain, simple, elderly lady who works for him and doesn't have many opinions on it. And then a very opinionated little girl who is like, oh, well, he, like, talked to my mom and he got me on this boat and we were all seasick and he carried me, but he gives me presents. And so, like, the view from, like, a child's perspective. And I just think that's an interesting addition to that as well.
Yeah. And I think the other piece that is very related to that is, even though we get Jane's perspective and we get what she sort of thinks to herself, we have talked about with Rochester how little descriptors of him there are and how many more descriptors there are of, like, what he's saying. Yeah. So even though we get Jane's perspective and we get some of her inner monologue about that, really the most that we understand about Rochester is what he says about himself. And I think that that's just a really interesting way to understand a character that leads into so much of his behavior being up for interpretation, the way that it is that I'm going to talk about a lot in some of the other topics that we're going to address today.
Seriously. Yeah. Especially, and I imagine this is kind of what you're hinting at, but a big thing that I was also going to talk about too is how much he deceives Jane. And so if a lot of what we know about Rochester is what he, the information he provides, you know, this tells us a lot about how skewed that possibly is.
Well, and I think this will lead really well into what we want to talk about for some of the next things. But a question that I have that I think is an unanswered question, but I'm curious about your perspective on, is at the end of the novel, when Jane goes back to Rochester and all of these secrets have been revealed and we know all these truths about Rochester, do we really? Do we really know him? Could we, do we actually, from what's in the text, do we actually know who Rochester actually is? Because we have a couple of other non-canon texts that add a lot of other dimensions to this character and interpret him in a very specific ways. Do you think at the end of this, we confidently know who Rochester is?
So here is my complicated answer to that question. I think we know who Rochester is at the end of the story, but we only know the version of him who is with Jane. And I say this by, what I mean by that is, I feel like a lot of people, if not most people, have a different side to themselves that they, that comes out when they're spending time with their significant other or their spouse or their partner versus who that person is when they're either completely on their own or if they're in, like, different kind of social groups. Because I know, like, when it's just me and my husband, Sam, like, we are very different. When we are with our group of friends, we are, like, way more, like, rowdy and we're rousing each other constantly. But when it's Sam and I, we have a lot more, like, intimate personal conversations and, like, deeper things. And, like, I'm also way different on my own than when I'm just with Sam and me. So I think, given, again, with the perspective of, we see him through Jane's eyes, I think we know really well who Rochester is at the end of the story, at least how he exists in his relationship with her. I think there's a lot more about the man on his own that we do not know.
Yeah, I think that that's true. But I also, like, I think a layer of this that I don't have, I don't think there's really a specific answer. I think, like so many things in Jane Eyre, it's intentional that it's unclear. But I do think there is a chance that this is, that there's another layer of deception. Like, that I think that we see, I think your point that, like, we understand the man that he is with Jane is so true, in that maybe that's just the way it is for everyone, right? Like, to your point, Sam has no idea who you are when it's just you and me and he's not there. He doesn't know anything about the just, frankly, nightmare that you become.
All I do is nag, nag, nag. I'm constantly insulting Lillian.
And honestly, like, bullying me and talking about how Who You Are with Sam is such a fake person and how like a part of you wishes he knew what a monster you were, like that kind of stuff. Like, he's just never going to know that.
It's so hard to pretend to be nice for the rest of my life. Someday I'll snap.
But that's the question, though. It's like, hey, we say that as a joke about you because that would be insane. But like,
I'm a sweetie.
That's a real question about Rochester. Is like, do we think, because there's a lot of things we're going to talk about, like, do we think that that's the last layer, that the truth about Bertha was the last secret, that was the only secret that he had? Or is there, are there more secrets yet to be known about this man that aren't in the book? And that, how could you, how could Jane really trust that she knows him now? Like, does she know him now?
I mean, I guess they have, from her perspective, she's got the rest of their life to figure that out.
But what if you found out there were more women? Like, what if you found out there was, there were like other things? Like, what if you found evidence that Bertha, like there was a secret letter under a floorboard and Bertha wasn't crazy? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. No, I mean, like, he's proven a pattern of like these many mistresses, which for me is always the rule breaker. I'm like, nope,
yep,
can't do it with this guy. Once a cheater, always a cheater. But like, that's the thing. And I want us to like save this, the rest of this conversation, I think, for once we get a little further on, to really discuss like everything that he's gone through and then kind of like come back to this one.
Because I think, I do think it's a question that comes to my mind a lot with Rochester. And I have my own opinions. And I want to sort of talk through all these different options, but I think my short answer to that now is we could know him. It's possible we know him by the end of the book, but it's possible we don't.
Totally. So this might help kind of break down some things. The way I broke up this next section is I titled this 50 Shades of Edward Rochester. Because I was thinking to myself, I was like, okay, what are the different buckets that I think this man falls into? And I came up with four, like, kind of descriptors.
Okay.
And so the way I personally see him most in the story, I think where he most kind of, his strengths mostly fall, I think that Edward Rochester is, first, an eccentric. I think he is a liar and a manipulator. That's one together. I think he's a caregiver, and I think he's a lover. These are my four main kind of descriptors for him.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've
got notes on each one. So if we want to use that to guide us at all.
Yeah, let's use that to guide us.
Okay. Cool.
You go.
So my first one, just like, this was the first one that just popped into my head because I always love, now that we talk about him so much, as this theater kid.
Yeah.
So, and essentially when we were thinking about, like, you know, what do other people see of him? He's kind of mysterious. He's different. So the eccentric kind of descriptor was the first one that I landed on. And the little things to kind of like break this down that I kind of highlighted. So we've got this theater kid element. And by that, I mean, we also have this fact that he likes to like dress up in costumes. He likes to play these games. And when I wrote that one down, at first I just meant it as a simple thing of like, oh, we know how much he enjoys the charades that he does at the party and all that stuff. But I'm like, but you could also see like his whole like courtship and seduction of Jane is this big game that he's playing. I also focus on this area. I think this is where we see his appreciation for art and theater. I think he is very much someone who is fascinated by what's different. He's bored by what is polite and tame. And also, I think the fact that he has this kind of temper goes into this eccentricity of the character.
I think it's interesting because I wonder, I think there's probably elements of that that are like inherent to his nature, right? Like there's parts of that that are just like he's a theater kid.
Yeah.
But how much are theater kids because they hung out with other theater kids, you know?
I think it's in your blood, Lillian. I think some people will, even if they're on like a remote military base, they'll still be singing show tunes while they push the mop around. You can't take it out of your blood.
But I think that one of the things that, as you were saying that, and that eccentricity that he has and how he like doesn't really care for the rules of society and therefore does some weird stuff. It makes me think about, and this is going to take a, this is going to seem like it's taking a turn in a specific direction, and I promise you guys it's not. but I recently saw this video that I've been thinking about a lot. that was specifically in reference to the idea of like queerness. I do not think that Edward Rochester is gay. That's what I want to be super clear about. That's not the point I'm going to make here. The point that I do want to make is he's somebody who has had a moment in his life where he no longer fits well within society's bounds. So the parallel there to queerness is that we have all these boxes that we live in. We have all these labels. And the video that I saw specifically was talking about the idea that, like, at some point, if you are queer, you have a box of men are with women and women are with men. And you go outside of that box. And so you're outside of one of the standard boxes of society. And then it starts to make you question other parts of different boxes. So, for example, women have long hair, men have short hair. Like that's a box that society tends to have. So that box no longer needs to apply to you because all of the boxes become irrelevant. Women wear dresses to fancy occasions. Men never wear dresses. Like these are all boxes that exist in society that when you go outside of one of these standard boxes, you start to question the other boxes that you're in. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Rochester was someone prior to Bertha where he fit within those boxes and he did what he was supposed to do based off of those boxes. One of those boxes is if you are married, you can't sleep with other people. Mm-hmm. Rochester no longer cares about that box. And I wonder about that with some of the other things that he does. Like, when you're a sane human being, you don't dress up like a fortune teller and try to trick your house guests into telling them their deepest, darkest secrets.
He is definitely a bit of an anarchist, a very, very mild one. But if you look at like him being like, no, ultimate screw you to society, I'm going to go put on a dress and try to con my guests into thinking I'm an old woman and get them to confess their deepest, darkest secrets to me. Like, that is unhinged.
And I think famously Victorian England was pretty obsessed with boxes and really wanted people like staying in there.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to think about the eccentricities of Rochester kind of stacked up against what we know about him and about the fact that he's somebody who his life no longer fits in any of these boxes.
Yeah. I was thinking too, just now with you saying that is that I feel like another fun thought experiment is to say like, if Rochester had existed like in a more modern time, he wouldn't have had most of these problems to navigate. Yeah. He could have just been a kind of like out there guy and it wouldn't have been a scandalous thing. He could have gotten a divorce. He could have gone and done other things.
Yeah.
But because of the restraints of society, and maybe that's another thing to say is like, actually, maybe if we put him on like a modern day level plane, he's not that odd of a person. It's just simply back then they're like, oh, blasphemy. Like, oh my gosh, did you see what he did? He walked away from that man and didn't say hello. It was shocking. And it's just like, he's like, no, I don't care about that guy. I don't want to talk to him. So I'm not going to go talk to him.
Well, and it's, would he be eccentric? Like, would he choose to dress up like the fortune teller? Like, would he be that? And not that specifically, right? But like the idea of like, would he shun society if he had just been able to get a divorce?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he would still be this theater kid because I stand by that. I think he will always be someone in another world. He is like a theater manager and or like even in like an actor himself. Like he's like involved in the arts. He's traveling around. He's carefree without responsibility. He can love whoever he wants and just experience life and do those things. But that wasn't where the situation that he was born into. But he still has those wants. And so he is fortunate enough to be a wealthy man who can be like, well, I'm going to still go after what I want.
Yeah.
Even if it bothers other people. And I think that's kind of what puts him in this eccentric category.
Yeah. I think it's hard to picture who Rochester would be without the constraints of that society for a few reasons. One, that's the only context we have him in. Mm-hmm. But two is having the secret of mm-hmm. Bertha is such a formative part of his life.
Yeah.
That it's sort of like there's a couple of formative experiences I can think of in my own life that it's like, who would I be without XYZ? Mm-hmm. And you don't know.
Right. Another kind of positive spin I want to put into the eccentric category. Yes. So another thing that I included in this was his fascination with things that are different.
Yeah.
And because if we think about like, I think he's drawn partially to Jane's uniqueness, I think, because we've talked about he sees a similarity to himself in her. I think he also is envious of like her ability to be defiant. And there's things that he would love to defy, and he sees her standing strong and not backing down and refusing to fit into other boxes as well. So I think mm-hmm. he admires that in her. But there's also, I think, like the way that he like constantly is referring to her in this kind of fantastical sense with these references to fairies and like mythical creatures and things like that. I think that shows that he has a tendency toward fantastic thoughts and wonderings.
Yeah.
And I also think like the way that he talks, even though the whole story is written very poetically because it is Charlotte who is writing it, mm-hmm. she makes him sound far more eloquent and like thoughtful than a lot of the other people that we hear speak, especially the people at the party. They seem to only say, like, they kind of following a script. They say what's expected. And I think the fact that he like has these different like observations and takes and more kind of contemplative like ways of seeing things, it kind of almost seems to me like everyone was required to like read these classic texts, but mm-hmm. while people just like read it or read the notes, then he actually like cared about it and dove into it and was like, yeah. I actually really like what this is talking about, and I want to know more about this, and I wish everyone cared about this thing so we could just talk about weird shit. Like, yeah. I think that's a positive thing that isn't Bertha influenced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. I don't have any more thoughts. I just agree.
Cool. Cool. My next little description, which is probably going to take up a big chunk of this discussion, is that I think one of his largest characteristics is that he is a liar and a manipulator.
Yeah. I think that that's so interesting. And the two, and I have notes on what I think is going to be the follow-up to these four sections, but I can talk about them now if it makes sense, which is like Rochester as a hero or Rochester as a villain and the ways that that can be interpreted. And I think that this to me is the fundamental reason why I don't have a solid answer there.
Yeah. And I have that section after this as well.
Because I think that Rochester is inherently someone we cannot trust. Mm-hmm. And he's also the only source of information on so many things.
Yeah. We've talked a lot when we were going into the book about how much he gatekeeps information from Jane. And when you know that as a reader, how, especially as a more modern day reader, how mm-hmm. infuriating that can be, because it is kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? He's kind of a hypocrite when he, in one hand, praises Jane for being like, oh, you and I, like, we are equals, we're alike, no one else is like us. He kind of gives her this impression that they're on the same like level. But then mm-hmm. What she doesn't know is that he has all this information that he's keeping from her. So actually, they're not. He's definitely higher up than her because he has knowledge and is manipulating her and lying to her. And she doesn't know.
Well, and I think in some ways she's higher up than him because it's the line that he says earlier in the book of like, if I had met you when I was your age, I would be your equal. Mm-hmm. And that like, I would have, I think he knows he's morally mm-hmm. gray, and there's no way for him to be less than that.
Yeah.
Or like more, like more morally acceptable. There's no way for that. And I think I have a similar question to the question I had with the eccentricities is he a liar and manipulator by circumstance or by nature? Like, would he be a liar and manipulator if he didn't have such critical secrets to keep?
Yeah. I want to say that one is situational as well. Mm-hmm. But again, this is like all just what do we personally think.
Yeah.
There's no facts to draw on really that could like back this up or confirm one way or the other. But yeah, I feel like his lying, I don't know. I often think about the way that he seems, at least in my mind, when I think of this like naive, inexperienced young man who went off to Jamaica, mm-hmm. I imagine him as being like rather hopeful and trusting. And then just got into a situation that he then was like, oh, this is permanent and this sucks. And now I'm here probably until she or I die. Like, and that blows and I hate that. And then it just led to kind of like, I think the lying and the manipulation that was his choice of an escape. Mm-hmm. To be like, yeah, no, I'm a wealthy man. I have just in my father and brother who did this to me are dead. So I don't have to do anything for them. They're not going to watch me or like judge me. So I'm the master of my house. I'm making the decision for my own happiness and sanity. I'm going to put this woman away in my home and I'm going to go off to Europe and try and forget about her.
And so, and I think he does come from a notably long line of liars and manipulators though, because his dad did lie and manipulate him to get him there in the first place.
Yes.
So
yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's also like the pessimist in me would be more kind of like, well, just based on how society kind of like expects men to be at this time, probably most men at that time, would be kind of liars to some extent to the women in their lives. But then also like the optimist in me wants to like focus on like his sweetness and his vulnerability that he shows to us at moments and things like that. And I'm like, oh, but if he hadn't been set on this path, I think he could have been this better person.
Yeah. I think
he could have been that Jane.
If 22-year-old Rochester before going to Jamaica met 19-year-old Jane and they fell in love and they, and his father was a different person and he let them get married, I think he wouldn't, the person I envision Rochester being wouldn't lie and manipulate her.
Yeah.
They would have a really eccentric life, but they wouldn't lie and manipulate each other.
There's a line that I think about all the time from the 2003 Peter Pan movie that I love. That film has a narrator and like, it's right when the darling children are leaving with Peter Pan for Neverland and the parents have been notified by Nanny the dog and they are running to the nursery in slow motion being like, we have to get to our children. And the narrator says, it would be wonderful to announce that they had arrived at the nursery on time, but then there would be no story. And it's like, yeah, wouldn't it's fun to think about these happy endings right from the start, but it's like, but that's not a story one wants to read where everything's good at the start, good in the middle and good in the end. Like,
I mean, that's a lot of the romance books I read.
How cute. Well, if it's comfort escapism, then yes, that is okay.
It's not one we could talk about. None of those could we talk about for 2 years. So I guess that's probably the point.
So some of the details that I put into this bucket are his secretive nature, his mysteriousness, like this impression about him definitely lies within this area. He moves Jane around the truth. But also, which like, if it was just that, if it was just like not mentioning the wife and kind of playing this game, that would even be like a little more forgiving than the fact that once they're engaged, he straight up lies to her and gaslights her and tells her she's wrong. And is like, does that whole bullshit where he's like, a year and a day, I'll tell you, then you'll be trapped with me. And I'm like, dude, you fucking suck. Why are you doing this?
And here's my thing is like, a year and a day sucks, but it sucks so much more because he's gaslighting her in the process. Like, he's not saying, because let's imagine a different conversation where Jane comes to him and says, so this is the morning after her nightmare where she wakes up and Bertha's there ripping her veil and then leaves and Rochester tries to convince her it's not real. Let's say he figured out that it was in fact real, that he sees the ripped veil and he goes, Jane, I know what happened here. I know that it's stressful. And unfortunately, I just can't tell you what it is that's happening. I want to be able to be honest with you in this way, but I am in a situation where I cannot tell you that. But I promise you, I will be fully truthful. Give me a year and a day, and I'm going to tell you the whole story.
I feel like that's the exact same thing, though.
It's not the same thing, because in the book, what he says is, Jane, it was probably Grace Poole. I'm very scared. It's probably just like your imagination mostly. This probably didn't actually happen. Any other secrets that I might have, I'm going to tell you about a year and a day from now. Mm-hmm. Like it's different to me, yeah, because it's gaslight gatekeep first, mm-hmm, and then it's girl boss, you know, and that's not okay.
Yeah. No, it's all shady and bad.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's like the lowest point in the book with him for me.
And it's because I feel like there's times where I have to tell half truths to people, or I have to pretend that I don't know things that I do know. But most of the time, like let's say I was in a work situation, and it's the difference between saying, I have no idea what you're talking about, and saying, you know, I do have some context there, but I'm not in a position where I can share that with you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's different.
Yeah. But there's no way that he could say that and she wouldn't be like, wait, what the fuck does that mean? Like, but wedding's postponed until you tell me. Like,
I don't know that that's true. I don't know that that's true.
You think she would take that? She would be like, okay, I guess I'm still going to marry you with this weird promise on the table.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think so.
I don't know. That's an interesting thing.
Because I think it's the question of everybody lies. And if you're listening to this going, I don't lie, you're a liar. You lied.
You just lied to yourself.
You just lied to yourself, and honestly, us. But like, everybody says half truths. Everybody has like been in a situation where like they say they're on their way, and the idea of being on their way is true. Like, mm-hmm, they've been in a situation where somebody invites you to do something, and you say you're busy when you're not busy because you just don't want to do that thing. Like, there's people in your life that you don't like and you don't really want to spend time with. And so but you don't say that to them to their face, because that's unnecessary and mean.
Yeah.
But so everybody lies to an extent, mm-hmm, but there's situations where you are lying. The way that Rochester lies, and the way that it is different, is Rochester lies intentionally to get the outcome that he wants. Mm-hmm. And whether it's because he's so used to this, or because he doesn't really care if Jane knows the truth or not, he lies to her over and over and over again to try to keep her from finding out the truth. Like, he is not to get her to make the decision that he wants her to make. He's, mm-hmm, not even sharing as much as he could share. Like, he could share more. Mm-hmm. But he chooses not to.
Yeah. I think another interesting kind of thought experiment to do with this as well, because here we see him as this damsel. This is a weakness for Rochester. This is an element of his real life humanity that he has dug himself a hole. And I feel like most of us ideally should not be able to relate to getting into a lie this deep, but there is that kind of relatability of like, you start kind of like letting someone believe something that isn't true, and then you kind of fib a little bit and the lie gets bigger, and then it kind of starts to snowball, and that feeling where you're like, I'm in too deep now, like I could lose everything. It's kind of almost the gambler, I think, like mentality of saying like, I should pull out. That's what I should do. I should take what I have, some like scraps of my like humanity left, and I should like walk away with that, but I can't, because maybe I'll get away with it. Maybe like she'll never know, and then we'll be fine. And it's like, it's just interesting. I think that's such a like a relatable sense of like panic. I think what's fueling his motivation to do this horrible thing to this woman that he loves is this utter fear of losing her. And it's like, it's not a good reason. It's not a okay thing to do, but it's just like, when you try to put yourself into his mindset, why is this man making these decisions for someone he cares about?
Yeah.
It's based in fear, like all things.
Yeah.
Like all horrible things, it's based in fear.
And I think that that's where, for me, the way, and I'm just going to spoiler alert for my own thoughts later. I I personally think that Rochester is lying because of the circumstances that he's in. He's doing exactly what you said, where he's like painted himself into this corner. He's so used to lying and manipulating. He's not used to being able to trust any, like, imagine how exhausting your life would be if you couldn't trust anyone. Mm-hmm. Rochester has no one to talk to about this. Mm-hmm. This is happening. This is something that that is happening to him that he cannot tell a living soul on the planet. The mm-hmm. only person who knows what's happening is Grace Poole, and they are not friends.
Yeah.
And so, and she may not even know the whole truth. She may not know that that's his wife. Like, mm-hmm. Mrs. Fairfax probably doesn't know that Bertha's there. And if she does, very few adaptations or interpretations of this have Bertha as, or have Mrs. Fairfax knowing that Bertha is his wife. Mm-hmm. Like, and he cannot tell those people. Mm-hmm. There's no one that he can tell this to. And how that would change the way you look at the world and the way you communicate to the world. You would almost get to a point where you're lying to yourself and pretending that that person does not exist and she is a ghost.
Yeah, totally. It's like this whole kind of messed up, just like mental puzzle that he's in. So before we get into this hero villain thing, I just want to touch on some positive points too, because there's two other, well, I think it's interesting, right? This is why Rochester is fascinating. Why, like, so many people like stand and fangirl over him and they're like, no, like, you're wrong. He's perfect. 'Cause he has these other qualities too. Mm-hmm. And so I also listed him, and you could kind of put these somewhat in tangent. So we've always talked about him as this caregiver. He's like, you know, love language is gift giving. Mm-hmm. He just really wants to provide for people, which I do think is genuine. So this protective nature, which you could like spin this almost to like with his decision not to put Bertha in an asylum, like mm-hmm. that's as much of like care that he is emotionally able to provide to this woman who mm-hmm. he feels has ruined his life, but he's still not throwing her away. He is like, he's like still kind of providing for her. And yes, we can get into the details about why he could do more. But that's like an effort. The way that he brings Adele into his home instead of like leaving her, you know, he's like, well, I don't think she's my daughter, but she's also like probably going to have this horrible life if I don't take her, and I could give her something better. Probably it's not the best, similar to Bertha. I think there's actually really interesting parallels between taking both Bertha and Adele and like kind of locking them away in his mansion and then leaving again. Mm. Like, he does that with like all the abandoned women in his life. Yeah. He just puts them in cornfield and he goes away and he's like, cool, my staff will take care of these ladies, but I'm paying for it. So it's like, I'm taking care of them, kind of.
Yeah.
But then just like also the way that he obviously like dotes on Jane in many ways, especially once they're engaged and afterwards, of, you know, just wanting to give her everything. So that whole element is there. And this is also something, 'cause I feel like anything else that we talk about after the liar manipulator is just kind of cast in this like shadow, 'cause that will always be like this dark cloud hanging overhead. And so for everything, you could easily spin a negative, influence on that and be like, well, he's only doing those things so that he's not a full monster. So he doesn't get found out. So someone doesn't like, you know, take away the stuff that he wants to do, kind of a thing. But mm-hmm. you could also, like, that's the thing. When we see his dialogue and how poetically he speaks and how thoughtful and, like, I don't know, I think there's a tenderness that comes through in a lot of his soliloquies. And so I feel like that hints at a sense of genuine care that he feels for some of the people in his life.
Well, and I'm going to say something that's going to get real dark for a second, and then I promise it'll get lighter. but one of the things that occurred to me kind of as I was thinking about Rochester, and it is pulling from some of my notes that I was going to talk about later, but Rochester, when you think about especially him in terms of a caretaker, and if we pull it to the darkest possible version of what he could have done, you're right. He totally didn't. He had no one in this society would have been poo-pooed on Rochester for not taking Adele in. He could have said, I have no proof that that's my daughter, and done nothing. And everyone in that society would have been like, well, there's no proof that that's his daughter. So he's probably like, fine.
We all have little French bastards that they don't live with us.
Little French bastards that live in France in dirty, dirty brothels. And it's fine.
It's totally fine. Why didn't you bring yours home? Weird.
You weirdo.
That guy's so eccentric.
So darkest version of Rochester with Adele, he abandons her. Mm-hmm. Darkest version of Rochester with Bertha, he kills her. Yeah, why wouldn't he kill Bertha? That's the absolute darkest. All of his problems.
I don't know. Okay, so that would actually be. I feel like we maybe had this discussion before, like who would win, Bertha versus Rochester? Because they describe him as very like athletic and masculine, but she's crazy. Like she will definitely like do whatever it takes. And she's tried many times burning him already.
So yeah, she's actively trying to kill him. But like let's darkest version of Rochester. He realizes she's crazy. Or he decides she's crazy. He realizes that he's in Jamaica or the West Indies. And nobody knows that he's married. Nobody knows who Bertha is. He owns all of her stuff. His father dies, his brother dies. He does not like it there. He does not want to be there. And he wants to have a new wife and a new life. There's a lot of ways that he could have killed her and nobody would have believed that this rich white man, nobody would have, even if they believed it, they wouldn't have prosecuted him. And very few people would have even known that he had a wife who died. That would be the easier way for him to live his life.
Yeah.
Is to abandon and or murder her.
But then that gets into the whole thing. Because I do feel like we see how much he already wrestles with his moral conscience. And this, like, even just having her locked in an attic, I think is too much for him. He couldn't deal with murdering somebody.
So that's where I'm saying, I don't think, Rochester didn't murder Bertha. Like, so the question is, why didn't he murder her? And there's a level of, because it would make his life easier, right? Like, there's no way it didn't occur to him. People told him to beat her. Those same people would not have a problem with him deciding she was too much trouble. So what is this taking it back to this caretaker version of him? He cares about her and he wants her and he feels responsible for her and he wants her to live whatever life she can live. And this is the best life he can give her. He takes Adele and gives her the best life he can give her. Rochester by himself does not think he could be a good dad. And also, being a good dad in Victorian England is doing exactly what he did. Mm-hmm. Being a good dad is not like sitting around and listening to her stories. The kids didn't eat with their parents at dinner.
Yeah.
Like the queen in the 20th century used to see her kids for an hour once a day. They would have the nannies bring the kids in for an hour. And she was such a good, involved mother.
Wow.
This is not the expectations for what a father is. He is going above and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all these things. Mm-hmm. I want to talk quickly about his role as this like passionate lover, and then we can get into our hero villain. And when I say that, I don't mean necessarily sex, okay?
Okay.
Like what I mean is, so here's the way I've broken this down. My first note literally is not just in the romantic sense. Okay. I'm not just talking about Toby Stevens bending Ruth over and making out with her collarbones, okay?
Okay. I don't know why. Somehow when you said that, when something about you saying collarbones and not collarbone, made me picture him with two, like, turkey bones, like extra bones left from something going...
Yeah, he's just kissing the wishbone. But no, so like I would put like the descriptors that make him this like lover archetype is we have many instances throughout the story where we see how passionate he is. I also feel as if his kind of like this passion, there's like a level of devil may care kind of like ambition to that would fall into this classic kind of like lover seducer kind of archetype.
Yes.
And so his with his like throwing off the shackles of society and seeing Jane and wanting her and his decision to like court her and seduce her and manipulate her, like that all falls into that. So there's negative predatory things about that, but there's also like anything that is tender and passionate and sincere, I think, can also fall into this. These are like whisperings of sweet nothings. These are the ways he talks to her when in that brief window of time they're engaged and he's like finally can say everything that he's wanted to say to Jane. And it's just like very steamy. And he's just like, I will give you the world. I will conquer nations for you. I will lay diamonds at your feet. I will pour them into your lap. I will make you never want to leave like your bed and like all kinds of wonderful things that he says. But then it's also, I think, like this level of, I kind of, part of the poetry of him, I think, falls into this as well. And we get to see these in these brief moments of vulnerability, which I think in this kind of more like romantic lover side of things, like that is normally something that, you know, if you have to constantly be this like tough, unfeeling man in this society, to let that wall down and let the woman that you care about see this kind of soft, loving side of you, there's that there too. And Jane gets to see that. And that's something that we can't help but fall in love with as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no additional thoughts. You nailed it.
Woo! Cool. But I just wanted to like, because throughout this whole discussion, as we now talk about like, is he the villain? Is he the hero? Blah, blah, blah. Like all of these elements are at play here because he's not just the guy who lied to seduce his 18-year-old employee. He's also the guy who I think I would say genuinely is fascinated and cares about her and like wants to have this better life, but was robbed of it and all these other things. So these all must be taken into account as we have this next discussion.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, let's start with, so I kind of want to talk about this in the hypothetical of he is the villain. Like, and there's a few things I have in my notes here. I think we're uniquely qualified for a lot of things because we're so special. But I also think there's three of the books that we've read inspired by Jane Eyre, decided that to paint him as if he was a villain. So Wide Sargasso Sea, I think probably the most human villain in that one. Very, very villainous, but just a little dummy. Then there's Reluctant Immortals, where he is an immortal nightmare creature. And then Reader, I Murdered Him, where I think that's the, it turns out this was another mask that he had with Jane. And he is creepy and a nightmare. And I think that what is interesting about all three of those, and is sort of what I want to take some time to talk about here, is it's again that what I said about at the beginning, where it's like our only perspective of Rochester, the primary source that we have about who Rochester is what he says about himself. And we don't see enough of his actions outside of this time where he's a liar and manipulator to know if that's true or not.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
So let's talk about it.
I mean, so, well, we can only go off of what actions he has in the book and what we have information there. We can't really hypothesize. Well, we can hypothesize, but not based on what is like written in the original text. But like, yeah, with the villain, I mean, it's easy to break it down and be like, no, this is a guy who locked his wife in an attic with no windows, which that is canon. There's like no windows up there. Limited her access to humanity and decent care. Locked her away and wanted to just simply forget about her as he fucked off and disregarded her and the promise of their marriage while he went off and slept with other women. And then when he got bored of that, he saw this sexy little 18-year-old and he was like, hey, gross. What's up, bookworm? Like, I know how to seduce you. I'm going to lie. I'm going to manipulate. It's going to be great. And then I'm going to shout at you until you marry me and all kinds of good stuff.
And Bertha only tries to burn the house down when Rochester's home. So that's one point against him.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he definitely does many dastardly activities in the course of this novel. There's no denying that.
And I think that we talked about a lot of my points that I had about Rochester being a villain. Like, he could be. If I think the biggest one, and we talked about a lot in our Bertha episode, which is like, he could be lying about her being crazy. She could just be like, a lot of the things that he says is like, she was lewd and like, she's kind of like the meanest thing we would call her now is like, maybe a slut who swears a lot. Like, is that is that a problem bad enough to be locked in an attic?
No, nowadays, no. Back then, they're like, oh, she's the spawn of Satan.
Well, get her. It's like, and was that what it was? And he just like decided to lock her in an attic? Or was she biting people? You know what I mean? Like, was she like attacking anyone because she was having some sort of delusion? Like, that it's we do not know.
Yeah.
And there's no way to know, because after you've been locked in an attic for that long, you're going to act like a crazy person, whether you were crazy going in or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. So it's hard to say. I think it's so interesting. I think about like often conversations I've seen in like the Facebook fan group of some people who are such diehard Rochester fans, and they will like go to their grave defending him. And it's also interesting to see the other people who are like, I think still, because they're in the fan group, they love the story, and they're like, I still definitely like have a crush on this problematic character, but let's discuss like maybe the not great things, because you have to acknowledge the bad as well as the good. You can't just see one side of it.
Yeah. And I think that he's more interesting. I don't think that he's, it's funny because I think he's more interesting of a character, and it's a more interesting book because he's morally gray. We've talked about this a lot before, but I do feel like mentioning it again now. Like, I don't like morally gray humans. Like, I think we all have, that's not to say you have to be perfectly moral all of the time. But like, if I found out that one of our close friends had a human being locked in an attic because they thought it was the right choice for that other human being, I'll be like, hey, that's not okay. And that's not somebody I'm going to try to build a life with.
No, definitely not. The red flags are numerous. But the other thing that I think we also, well, hang on, I'm going to save that for later. Let's also, from the hero side of things too.
Yes.
If we take him at his word, he did the best that he could do. It's like the argument that I see the most, where everyone's like, he didn't put her in an insane asylum. He didn't kill her. He tried to care for her. He did the best that he could. He was stuck in a crummy situation. The sleeping around doesn't really have any excuses.
I personally find the sleeping around not as bad as you do.
For me, like, if Bertha is a sane woman, and he locked her away to go like fuck other women, that would be like, oh, yes, you dead.
That's an argument for the villain. Like, if he wanted to go fuck around and he didn't like her anymore, and so he went and slept with a bunch of other people, that sucks. But I think that if we're telling the hero story, if we're painting it like clear white knight, he has this woman that he can't, like, imagine the only scenario that I've been able to think about that you would stay married to someone now is like, if you legally needed to be able to legally take care of them. He needed to be their legal guardian. Because if you get divorced, the person who would get legal guardianship over this person is a bad person. Like, their parents are a nightmare. And so you need to be able to stay legally bound to them. And you put that person, you get that person the best care. They're watched full around the clock. It's like, if somebody has a spouse who has really severe dementia or Alzheimer's, and that person is no longer the person you fell in love with and married, I think it's okay to go and see other people. Like, I think that that's, and keep this on the record in case I fall in love, get married, and lose my mind.
Be like, look, Lillian's future girlfriend / wife, she said it was okay. So go.
I have it on a podcast.
Go nuts. Go have fun.
So it's like, I think him sleeping around, at the time it wasn't okay. I think now I think it's fine. I think he's trying to, if he really was caring for her the best that he could, and she wasn't a true partner, I personally feel like he's allowed to do that.
Yeah. And I guess for me, it's not just the matter that like he's like a boy whore going around sleeping with a bunch of people. It's more for me that he is, it's what is revealed to be his opinion of these yeah. women that he definitely looks down upon when he's trying to like be like, well, you're not like those sluts, Jane. I can't stand that. I'm like, dude, you do not see women as equals. If
for
you
sure.
see those people as lesser than you, which you clearly do, like, there's part of your subconscious brain that also puts Jane into that category, yeah. and that's not cool.
I think there's a layer of villainy to me that, like,
yeah.
he demonstrates. It's one of the things that makes me think that maybe Bertha wasn't as crazy. It's like he demonstrates in that moment that he doesn't think Jane is like other girls. And let's pretend that, like, Celine is like a nightmarish, truest sense, like. I don't love the term gold digger, but like, let's say that she doesn't care about anyone and she could have made money with somebody who like was fine with that arrangement, but she explicitly went after Rochester because she knew that he was easier to manipulate because he was looking for love. Mm-hmm. Like, let's make her super villainous. Let's make the other person like so boring and so dumb and just like also like, we've all met people like that at some point in our lives. Like, it's not nice to say mean things about them, but my God, have mm-hmm. like anything interesting to say. Mm-hmm. And that's one of these other women. Like, maybe that's the case. I don't love that he doesn't have a single woman that he can give an example of that he finds interesting and compelling other than Jane, because yeah. he talks about everybody else that way. But like, in the most generous reading of this man, maybe Jane is special, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's also, yeah, I don't know. Because it's like, then I'm like, okay, but you can't be like that. Either you're a horrible judge of character that you chose those awful people as your partners in the past.
Yeah.
Or you were incredibly vain because you didn't take the time to figure out what their personalities were. You just wanted to be with them because they were hot and they would sleep with you. And none of these things are good. There's no positive spin on that in my mind.
Yeah. I think there's if we're going with the most positive way that we can read him, because I'm doing the same thing with the villain stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the most positive way we can read it is those women were truly, they were truly less interesting or
yeah.
more like just crueler. And mm-hmm. we can talk about the circumstances that those women were in and why they potentially were like that. But I think if we're doing the most heroic reading of him,
yeah,
he has bad options and yeah. he was trying his very best.
Mm-hmm.
And the only women who were open to the arrangement that he was looking for mm-hmm. were not the kind of women that the other thing too is if Rochester that I think leans into the hero reading of it is if Rochester wanted someone who would be easy to manipulate and he could have full control over, those kind of women are easier to find in mm-hmm. the circumstances he's in.
Yeah.
What he wanted was somebody who really was his equal and mm-hmm. really could like who was truly a partner. He was looking for a partner.
Yeah.
And he finds that in Jane and makes shitty choices. Like, it's interesting because I think Sirian Hines, after the discovery of Bertha, most villain reading. Mm-hmm. But I always will remember the scene when he's walking with her and after Mason, and they're having the conversation about like in this hypothetical, mm-hmm. Who does this moral qualm fall on? Like, who yeah. has to make this moral choice? And I believe that that version of Rochester and that interpretation of Rochester is he's not lying to Jane because he wants to lie to Jane. He's lying to Jane because he is taking the moral burden on mm-hmm. of the choices that they're making. And he doesn't want her to put her in a choice. He doesn't want to put her in a choice of having to make that choice herself.
Yeah, there's definitely that read. I think I'm thinking too back on the book Mr. R, which is another modern yes. day kind of retelling. And I think in the early part of that story, she did a really good job of making him sympathetic, of going through these situations. And I think what she did to make that work was that in that case, because it was kind of from his perspective as well. Like it would jump from points of view. And there he's someone who, if we see him from this kind of like sensitive artistic side, who tried to be vulnerable to people and open his heart up. And every time he opened it, someone would like take a little chunk. And eventually when by the time he meets Jane, he's like closed up his heart. And he's like, no, I've been hurt too many times. I'm just going to decide that the world sucks and nobody's any good. And then he sees Jane, who is this kind person and like a sweet person that he like relates to. And he's like, oh, do I dare open this broken little heart again? Like, so I think that's like another way you can kind of read that is that he's not a victim, but he's also been hurt many times. And again, I honestly feel that all elements of hate stem from a place of fear or pain or misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And so it is simply his way of defending himself from that by like hurting others before they can hurt him. And things like that, which again, it's not a good ethical way to do things and to move about your life. But I think that's why a lot of horrible people do what they do.
Yeah.
The other thing about him as a hero, I think just if we just live in a bubble of Jane in Rochester, where she comes from so much cruelty and he is someone who is kind and sees her potential, sees her cleverness, sees her where everyone else is like, oh, that's just a little person. And he's like, no, that's Jane Eyre. Yeah. Respect her. She's important. I respect her.
So I think another thing sort of related to that is he values Jane for who she is, mm-hmm. not how she looks, not like any of these other things. He values Jane. And I think that's part of the reason. It's the thing that really bothered me about Cyrian Hines' read of her in that interview he did where he talked about like, he was like rich and powerful and that's why women liked him. And I'm like, no, he talked to Jane like she was a person of worth. Mm-hmm. Do you know how low the bar is, my guy? That still in 2023, we are reading this book going, God, I wish I could find a man who talked to me like I mattered. Like that, that is, he talks to her like her ideas matter. He cares what she thinks about. Mm-hmm. He thinks that her art is interesting and worthy of note. Like he thinks that Jane is a person who deserves respect and to be listened to.
Yeah.
And it's, that is incredible.
It's that equally tumultuous line when she's leaving and he like grabs her for that moment. And it's like, it's so bizarre because it's simultaneously kind of on the verge of rapey when he's like, I could bend you with my finger and thumb. Mm-hmm. Like I could take you if I wanted to, but I don't want your body. I want your soul. I want who you are. And so it's like, I'm at the same time, like telling you that you are an important individual, but also I have the ability to take what I want, but I'm not going to. It's just like, well, oh my God.
I think it's that line. I think what's interesting about that line is like, he can have all the power in the world, but you cannot bend someone's soul to your will.
Yes.
And it's so interesting how that line alludes to his perception of people, which we talk about, which he talks about earlier, where he says the line of anyone would do any mercenary, like anyone would do something for a salary. Like you don't know anything about people if you think that people wouldn't do something for a salary. And Jane won't do this for something so much more valuable to her than a salary, which is the love for life.
Yeah.
Like she won't bend for that. And I think that it's interesting what his experiences were leading up to that, where he was under the impression that human beings would do anything for a something as small as money.
Yeah.
And Jane, who values humans and people and love, won't do it for being loved, which is what she has wanted and never gotten in her life. She only got it from two people, both of whom are no longer accessible to her.
Right. Another kind of like, this will be kind of one of my wrap-up thoughts, but something that I was thinking about, because I literally just had a similar conversation to this with Sam the other night. So when kind of like looking at him as a whole. And I think it is kind of healthy to see Rochester as a villain, but it's almost like an anti-hero that we're supposed to fall in love with. This is a villain we're supposed to love.
Yeah, it's the Byronic hero thing.
Yes, exactly. And so what I come down to is, like, let's look at what his intention is, which I do personally believe, in just my reading of him and my love of the character, is that Rochester wants to do good. Like, he wants that. He wants to be better. But then we also have to look at his respect and restraint when it comes to, like, not compromising certain morals to achieve what he wants.
Yeah.
And again, that kind of goes back to, like, what you were saying, like, oh, well, he could kill Bertha. And, like, in a gross, evil, dark, one awful situation, we could say he could have raped Jane. He could have, like, taken something. Like, he could have done so much worse. But that's not a good way to, like, judge someone. We can't go through life and, like, look at a guy who stole 20 bucks from his boss, and then we're like, well, at least he didn't burn the building down. It's like, that's not how you judge people, by comparing extremes.
Is that, like, you not have to, how, like, I'm supposed to be judging people? Because I should probably... that I'm going to need some time to marinate on that one.
Because it's like, I mean, things are still morally wrong, and you have to take lots of things into account when you are making these decisions. But it's also like, how do you balance that? And just like a kind of comparison that I had recently made. So, like, Sam and I are just wrapping up The Sopranos. And we had also previously together watched Breaking Bad. And I famously hate Breaking Bad because I can't stand Walter White. Because Walter White is a main character who is definitely a villain. But I feel as if he has, like, no redeeming qualities and is only out for his own self-interest. He doesn't care about anybody else.
I couldn't watch Breaking Bad. It was too spooky for me.
Don't watch it, Lillian. It made me depressed. And I am the most positive person that I know. So, the show ended and I was like, I think I don't believe in hope anymore. The show killed my belief that things can be better. Like, that show literally...
I have said about you that you're the most positive person I know, but I've never in my entire life heard someone say, I'm the most positive person I know.
Well, I'm sorry. I haven't met someone more positive than me. Because it's hard to be that in today's day and age. But then similarly, like, Tony Soprano is a character who does a lot of things wrong, but he is someone who, like, very clearly is trying to be better and is doing these things for his loved ones.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's an element of that. This is for other listeners, I suppose. And for me to just be able to say it on air.
That's
like an element of that to Rochester too. So I think he falls more into a Tony Soprano category and not a Walter White.
I think to get my sort of wrap up thoughts and feelings, I also read Rochester the softest soft boy. Like, I think he's just a sweet little bean. And I have a much more generous reading of him than I think most people do. But I think ultimately what I find compelling. We talked about this so many different times, but what I can find compelling about the story overall is conversations like this, is the ability to flip this character around and be like, well, this is how I think of him when I'm reading the book, because if I didn't, I would hate it. But how can you see this differently? And Charlotte Bronte, I believe, was leaving it open to interpretation intentionally. I think that she probably has in her own mind how she sees how Rochester actually is. But I personally believe that she left him open to interpretation intentionally. Mm-hmm. I think she left the possibility of him being a villain in the text intentionally. And I think it's what makes it fun.
Yeah, I do. I was trying throughout this discussion to kind of not focus too much on a newly very prominent thought that I have when I consume this story, like, in any version, is being like, I'm just always going to think about Jane just, like, writing this book because she had a crush on a married man. And so, like, all this stuff, I'm like, yes, there is this beautiful philosophy to it, but it's also definitely her giving herself a happy ending that she didn't get. And, like, but it's also, so that's like the surface level thing.
When you said Jane just now, did you mean Charlotte?
I meant Charlotte, which they're the same person. It's a self-insert.
We talked about this with Patrick, where this is not the first time one of us has said Jane when we meant Charlotte.
Yes. But it's also like, that's the thing. Everything about this is so multi-layered because yes, it's both her, like her real life fan fiction. But it's also, you could see like her processing the complicated emotions that she had from this like relationship with this guy.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that as well, and about that idea of like, is Rochester supposed to be this professor that she fell in love with? And I think as much as the answer to that is yes, the answer to that is also not the actual person. Mm-hmm. He's the idea that she had of him in her head.
Yeah.
So she had a very generous reading of this man when she fell in love with him. And she had this very generous reading. I mean, guys, I had crushes on men and I look back on those and go, oh, that wasn't real. And I think that that's some of what's happening here. It's like, honestly, from the little I know about this professor that she had this thing for, I think he was probably a piece of shit because he was flirting with Charlotte enough. He found this incredibly intelligent, interesting young woman and spent enough time with her in enough ways that she thought they had a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. And the only kind of person who does that is a piece of shit, whether mm-hmm. he's married or not. He was manipulating a teenager.
Yeah.
And it's fun to write books about somebody like that. It's fun to like have these imaginings about somebody like that. But the only people who do that in life are pieces of shit. Yeah. And so it's not about an actual person. It's about the fantasy man that exists in your mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the way I read it when I read the book. When I spend time thinking about this story, I read it as the fantasy man you have in your mind.
Yes, of course. And that's how he first appeared to me in the form of Timothy Dalton. Yes. So, yeah.
And Piper does only, do you still only see Timothy Dalton in your mind's eye?
For the most part, yeah. Yeah. When I was reading through some passages for the Nature episode, it's mostly him. Sometimes it's like George C. Scott. Sometimes it's just like a random other guy. That's like, yeah, it changes.
I see white man. I have generic white man.
There you go.
Sometimes he has a beard. Sometimes he doesn't. And I cannot remember canonically which mm-hmm. one he's supposed to have.
I think he's supposed to have like mutton chops, not a full beard.
Oof.
Yeah.
So definitely
not attractive.
Definitely neither. Mutton chops is the worst option.
It just is the worst option.
To end it on the most important thing about Rochester, worst option.
He had the bad facial hair.
Do we think he was attractive? Hard no.
No.
Do we picture him as attractive in our mind's eye? Yes.
Yes, because we want to fall in love with this guy. Come on. We're vain.
We are both gorgeous humans, yes. as you know, I'm sure. Yes. Probably the prettiest people on the planet. We really, it's why we relate so much to Blanche.
Well, it's why we had to do a audio-only podcast, because mm-hmm. if you saw us, you would fall in love with us, and you would stalk us. And
it's what's happened to both of us in our lives up until this point, which is people don't hear us because they're so entranced by our beauty.
I know. Yeah. Walking around with a bag on my head sure gets annoying sometimes.
I love that you don't go like mask, which is a thing you could get away with now.
No, paper bag with two eye holes cut
Piper's
out.
Piper's been doing full paper bag for a decade now.
Yeah, and I still have a job and a husband. Sam got to see my face for the first time on our wedding night and his like pupils melted out. Because it was too beautiful.
It was so gorgeous that his just like whole body couldn't handle it.
Amazing.
Next week.
What are we doing next week, Lillian?
So next week is our second to last episode. This is our last character study. I've said this before, but I'm going to say it explicitly again because I don't want people sending us messages about this. We're not doing a character study of Jane because the podcast is a character study of Jane.
Yes, the whole thing.
The whole thing. So next week, we are going to be doing an episode that is sort of a hybrid. We are going to watch the episodes that are available to us of the 1963 TV show. There's four of the six are available because the others were destroyed by the BBC. And then we will also be talking about some of the adaptations that we weren't able to watch, either because of accessibility to us, the fact that they no longer exist in the world, which is devastating, or because they were long and I didn't want to.
All good reasons. When you say destroyed, it's like there was a fire, right? It wasn't like they saw the second half of this and they're like, this sucks, burn it.
No, it's so first of all, it's episodes 2 and 3 are the ones that are missing. Mm. And I was reading about this. Film is very expensive to archive because mm-hmm. you have to have a lot, it takes up a lot of physical space. Mm-hmm. And then it also could be recycled to be used like again for other things. So the BBC in the 60s had no budget left. Like it was like really didn't have a lot of money. So in the late 60s, early 70s. And so they lost a lot, like they lost a lot of episodes of Doctor Who no longer mm-hmm. exist because of it. They just didn't have the money to store all of this film. And they also reused some of it for other things, is my understanding. And if anybody knows more, keep that to yourself.
Yeah, we're wrapping up. We don't want to learn stuff anymore. Closing our brains.
If you're listening to this the week it comes out, the week of Christmas, you do have one opportunity. You can send us an email, airbuds@gmail.com, or you can send us a DM on Instagram @airbuds or any of the other platforms that we're on. But it's a small window of time that you can tell us about this.
I forgot this. Halfway through, I forgot this is our Christmas episode. And now I'm like, oh, Merry Christmas. We're talking about how Rochester like could have raped and murdered and done all this icky stuff.
If you're listening to this on Christmas Day, I hope this was what you were hoping it would be. If you're not, that was maybe the right choice.
Yeah, maybe. Good for you. Anyway, we love you guys. There's still time to leave 5-star reviews because the podcast will remain even though we won't make new episodes. So get in front of more people.
Don't you want a bunch of people to find this after it's like done and like listen to it and you can be a cool, like, wouldn't it be hilarious if our podcast went super viral after we finished it?
Yeah.
Like you could be a part of making that happen.
So leave a 5-star review on your favorite platform of choice. Reach out to us at airbuds@gmail.com. And until then, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy Hanukkah, all that good stuff. We love you guys. Happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye.
Goodbye.